now. Maid Isma leave, with a shrieking flapping of arms, mad woman behavior that finally drove her away. Downstairs, a pounding sound. What? Someone trying to break in, to break the house from inside for the crime of having been a roof over the terrorist's head. Picked up the electric kettle with four heat settings, the closest thing to a weapon that remained. Opened the door to David Beckham, the Queen, Zayn Malik, boarding up the broken windows. Beckham almost hammered his thumb in surprise. Didn't think anyone was here, he said, from behind the mask, with the voice of Abdul. Better go inside. There may still be journos lurking, said Zayn Malik, who was really David Beckham's father. Cuppa would be lovely, though, said the Queen, a.k.a. Nat the Greengrocer, jerking her tiaraed head toward the kettle. 12. Countless hours of recording and never his own voice, as though he'd started to practice disappearing long ago. Now he wouldn't even enter her dreams. Too angry. 13. How many Parvez Pashas will it take for the government to wake up? The revelation that Adil Pasha, the father of recently dead terrorist Parvez Pasha, abandoned his family in order to take up jihad, has not entirely come as a surprise to one former classmate of the Preston Road resident. There was a rumor that his father had been a jihadi in Afghanistan who died in Guantanamo, said the classmate, who wished to remain unnamed. His sisters always denied it and said he'd died of malaria while abroad, but Pervez never did. I didn't think anything of it at the time, but looking back, it's obvious he thought jihad was something to boast about when he was still just a little kid. Sources at the Met say Adil Pasha fought with jihadi groups in Bosnia and Chechnya in the 90s and traveled to Afghanistan in 2001 to fight with the Taliban. He is believed to have died soon after. We have no idea if he was killed in a battle or died of malaria or from other causes. But if he'd ever been in Guantanamo, there would have been records, and there simply aren't, said a retired special branch officer who interviewed the Pasha family in 2002. I remember the son, Parvez. He was very young, but was already being allowed to idolize the father who fought with Britain's enemies. I took away the photograph album he had with pictures of his dad holding a Kalashnikov and an inscription saying, "One day you'll join me in jihad." I recommended CPS keep a close eye on him, but unfortunately this recommendation was never taken up. It's a cause of profound concern that the children of jihadis, many of them British-born, are not closely watched by the state. How many more Parvez Pashas will it take for things to change? 14. He'd returned from the Pakistan High Commission that day to say he didn't have to pay the exorbitant visa fees for British nationals or go through bureaucratic processes in order to work in Karachi because turns out he had something called a NICOP. Oh, yes, Isma said. I got them for all of us when I was planning that trip to Pakistan, which never happened, remember? Up to the attic Parvez went, and down he came triumphant. One for you and one for me, he said, handing Anika the laminated card with National Identity Card for Overseas Pakistani printed on it. She glanced at the picture, remembered then how sullenly she had accompanied her sister to the High Commission to have the card issued, hating the idea of missing a summer in London, to spend it in a country teeming with relatives who thought blood ties gave them the right to interrogate and lecture and point to the sisters' hijabs as proof that British Pakistanis were caught in the past, then point to their genes to prove they were mixed up. It didn't improve her mood to see that the card insisted on listing name of father. In the end, though, something in the phone conversations with the rich relatives who had promised to fund the trip had gotten Isma's back up, and the cards were dispatched to the filing cabinet in the attic, along with birth certificates and NHS cards and x-rays of broken bones. "What is an overseas Pakistani exactly?" she asked. Parvez shrugged. "Think it just means your family's from there, so you're exempt from visas. Anyway, that's the only part that's relevant to me." "To us?" she said. "I'll need it when I come to visit you. Put it in my purse, would you? I don't want to have to go up to the spidery attic to find it when you're gone." She had no memory of his expression as he did as she asked. Now the laminated card with her sullen 14-year-old self sat on the desk at the High Commission, while the man with the plastic comb in his pocket looked sadly down on it. "You should do what your older sister says and stay away," he said. "Ladies don't go for the burial anyway, so you would only be praying at home, which you can do just as well in London as in Karachi. Allah would hear even a prayer whispered by a mute from the bottom of the world's deepest ocean." "Am I or am I not entitled to a Pakistani passport?"
"Yes."
"I have a bank draft for the urgent processing fee. Please tell me who I should give it to." 15. Ho Jabi, Pervy Pasha's twin sister, engineered sex trysts with Home Secretary's son. Anika Nickers Pasha, the 19-year-old twin sister of Muslim fanatic Parvez Pervy Pasha, has been revealed as her brother's accomplice. She hunted down the Home Secretary's son, Ayman, 24, and used sex to try and brainwash him into convincing his father to allow her terrorist brother back into England. Nickers kept her true identity hidden from her lover until hours before her twin brother was fortunately killed while trying to enter the British consulate in Istanbul. Ayman Lone quickly informed the Home Secretary that the woman he had allowed into his bed wanted him to use his influence with his father to bring her evil brother back into Britain. Karamat Lone immediately contacted the security services, but before any actions could be taken, Pervy Pasha was killed. The brave Home Secretary, who has taken a strong stand against extremists at risk to his own life, had kept quiet while a police investigation was taking place. This morning, his office issued a short statement revealing the sordid affair and promised full transparency. Although the terrorist's twisted sister cannot be proved to have broken any laws, she has been told to keep her distance from the Home Secretary's son, who is understood to be staying with friends in Norfolk. She was barking up the wrong tree. The Home Secretary would never compromise this nation's security for any reason, say sources close to the Lone family. Inside. Daughter and sister of Muslim terrorists with history of secret sex life. The exclusive story of Nickers Pasha. 16. He looked like a taunt, tasted like a world apart, felt like barriers dissolving. He looked like opportunity, tasted like hope, felt like love. He looked like a miracle, tasted like a miracle, felt like a miracle. A real, actual, straight from God, prostrate yourself in prayer as you hadn't done since your brother left, miracle. 17. Packed a suitcase, wheeled it outside, the first time leaving the house in days, cameras, microphones, police holding them back. Isma rushing out from Auntie Nassim's house across the road. "Where are you going?" Isma not someone she ever had to answer to again. Kept walking. Police flanking her. "Miss, please go back inside." Stepped into the waiting car, Dame Edna this time, a.k.a. Abdul, who had become chief protector, ally, jumping garden walls to enter her house unseen by the press outside. Abdul, who had taken her token and picked up the passport, booked her ticket, paid for it, so that Isma wouldn't receive an alert from the credit card company. Joined quickly by a police escort, TV vans following. Never mind, nothing to hide, better this way.
Why are you helping me, Abdul?
Something about me you don't know.
I've known you're gay since before you did, probably.
Not that, but thank you for never mentioning. I told that Farouk's cousin who Parvez was. The rumours about your father, I mean. I think that's why Farouk came for him.
It's not your fault he went.
Why did he go?
I don't know exactly. I stopped asking it. He wanted to return home, that's what mattered.
If he comes back, Farouk, I'll kill him.
No, don't kill him. Take his skin off with the world's smallest scalpel. Remove his eyes with an ice cream scoop. Drip slow-working acid on his tongue.
You've thought about this, I guess. It's one of the few things I can concentrate on.
I don't think I could do any of that.
I know. It's okay. One other thing you don't know.
What's that?
Really fancied your brother,
said in a Dame Edna voice.
Thank you, Abdul. I'd forgotten what it felt like to smile.
At the airport, she expected the interrogation room again, but the man at the security checkpoint looked over her shoulder at the police, then down at her new passport and the boarding card to Karachi, and nodded her through.
"Why are you going?" one of the journalists called out from across the barrier, just before she walked into the departure lounge.
"For justice," she said.
18. Karachi. Colourful buses, colourless buildings, graffitied walls, billboards advertising cell phones and soft drinks and ice cream, birds circling in the white-hot sky. Parvez would have wanted the windows down to listen to every new sound, but she sat back in the car in silence, disrupted only by the rattling vents of the air conditioner. A silence not of her own devising but of her cousin's, the guitarist, who refused to explain why she had been escorted off the plane by airport officials, who drove her to the cargo terminal, where he was waiting to pick her up, in a beige car with a sticker on its windscreen announcing its membership to a golf club. It looked more suited to a businessman than a musician.
"Take off the hijab and put these on," was the only thing he'd said, passing her a pair of oversized glasses.
She refused, but eventually the sun's glare made her change her mind about the glasses. The silence continued until he turned into the driveway of a tall white hotel, cleared an ineffectual security check, and pulled over, waving away the valet who came around to take his keys.
"You can get out here," he said.
"For what?"
"Entrance to the hotel is through there. I've checked you in for 3 days, under the name Mrs. Gul Khan. His body arrives tomorrow. He'll be buried by the evening. We've arranged a funeral plot. I'll send a car to take you there the next morning, 9 a.m. You can pray over the grave and leave. Okay? Do not call me. Do not call my mother. You understand?"
"You're the one who needs to understand. He isn't going to be buried. I've come to take him home."
The cousin held his hands up.
"I don't want to know, crazy girl. I don't want to know anything. My sister lives in America. She's about to have a child there. Did you or your bench-hood brother stop to think about those of us with passports that look like toilet paper to the rest of the world? Who spend our whole lives being so careful we don't give anyone a reason to reject our visa applications? Don't stand next to this guy. Don't follow that guy on Twitter. Don't download that Noam Chomsky book. And then First, your brother uses us as a cover to join some psycho killers, and then your government thinks this country can be a dumping ground for its unwanted corpses, and your family just expects us to jump up and organize a funeral for this week's face of terrorism? And now you've come along, Miss Hojabi Knickers, and I have to pull strings I don't want to pull to get you out of the airport without the whole world's press seeing you. And it turns out you're here to try some stunt I don't even know what, but my family will have nothing to do with it, nothing to do with you.
I don't want you or your family to have anything to do with it. Just tell me what time tomorrow he's arriving and who to speak to about where to bring him.
What do you mean, where to bring him? You planning on checking a corpse into your hotel room?
You really want to know?
No. Get out. Who do I speak to about where to bring him?
He reached into his wallet, pulled out a business card, and threw it at her.
Thank you. By the way, how far are we from the British Deputy High Commission? Look at a map, he said, leaning across to open her door.
19. The British Deputy High Commission compound was surrounded by barbed wire, vans bristling with guns, and roadblocks to prevent any stranger's approach. But just a few minutes' walk away, there was a park, lined with banyan trees, their ancient overground roots more enduring than wire rusting in the sea air, or guns that jammed with dust, or the calculations made today by politicians looking to the next elections. Here, she would sit with her brother, until the world changed, or both of them crumbled into the soil around them.
Keramat. Chapter 8. Keramat Lone ignored the unusual twitchiness of the shadow stretched out alongside his on the Thames path, and poured a second shot of coffee from the thermos into a paper cup. On two separate occasions, Eamon had given him one of those insulated mugs as a birthday present. Well-intentioned, but oblivious to the mug's inability to keep a man's hands warm while doing the same for the coffee. When it came to his son, Keramat had always treated well-intentioned as good enough. With his daughter, the only other possible candidate for such preferential treatment, there'd never been any need. Poor fellow, he used to think, considering the gap in abilities and achievements between Eamon and his younger sister. It had never occurred to him that Eamon alone was blind. To his own, the word hurt in relation to a man's only son, but nothing else would do, inadequacy. All the good cheer Keramat had admired as a front became an embarrassment when revealed to be a genuine attitude. "She loves me," he had continued to insist, in the face of all evidence to the contrary. Why is that so impossible to believe? A question Keramat had hated answering. He held the paper cup to his face, allowing the steam to enter his nostrils, warm his cheeks. There was a precise calibration to how long you could do this before the temperature of the coffee dipped below optimum drinking temperature. He gulped down the coffee, felt it burn its way pleasingly through him while he continued to look at the Palace of Westminster and its watery reflection, the yellow stone pink gold in the interlude of sunrise. The heart of tradition, everyone agreed, but few understood Britain as well as Keramat Lone and knew that within the deepest chamber of that heart of tradition was the engine of radical change. Here, Britain whittled down the powers of the monarchy. Here, Britain agreed to leave its empire. Here, Britain instituted universal suffrage. Here, Britain would see the grandson of the colonized take his place as prime minister. The most constant criticism against Keramat Lone was that his positions flip-flopped between traditionalist and reformer.
But the critics learned nothing from their own inability to know which was which. Take, for instance, his intention to expand the Home Secretary's power to revoke British citizenship so that it applied to British-born single passport holders. It was, clearly, the sensible fulfilment of a law that was so far only half-made. You had to determine someone's fitness for citizenship based on actions, not accidents of birth. An increase in draconian powers, said one set of his opponents on the left. A renewed assault on true Englishmen and women by Britain's migrant population, said another set on the far right. Both sets probably drank coffee out of insulated mugs. You're doing the contemptuous thing again, Terry would say. It was one of his wife's few remaining misconceptions about him. Contempt, disdain, scorn. These emotions were stops along a closed loop that originated and terminated in a sense of superiority. In their preservation of the status quo, they were of no use to Keramatlone. A man needed fire in his veins to burn through the world, not ice to freeze everything in place. He'd thought he had mastered the art of directing the fire, but yesterday, with TV cameras on him, he'd heard the girl's one-line explanation for leaving England and hadn't been able to stop himself from responding, "She's going to look for justice in Pakistan?" That final word, spoken with all the disgust of a child of migrants who understands how much his parents gave up, family, context, language, familiarity, because the nation to which they first belonged had proven itself inadequate to the task of allowing them to live with dignity. At some point, he'd have to respond to the Foreign Secretary's irate message about his comment. Or not, if the PM kept up his silence. A silence Keramat worried had less to do with favouring his Home Secretary than with the PM's irritation at how Pakistan's Prime Minister was trying to make political capital of the situation. He'd sanctimoniously explained that Pakistan, as a matter of state policy, shouldered the cost of repatriating its citizens, while the UK government expected the bereaved to pay thousands of pounds to have the remains of their loved ones returned to them. A lycra-covered runner approached, swerved skin-scrapingly close to the Thames Path barrier as soon as he was close enough to recognise the Home Secretary, and held up a hand to the officers to indicate he wasn't a threat. Brown-skinned. Keramat clicked his tongue against the back of his teeth. He twisted off the thermos cap again, shook the container gently, considered the liquid swishing around the glass-lined interior. He didn't seem to need it, despite his total lack of sleep the previous night. The wonders of adrenaline. It had been a long time since he'd stayed up all night, wondering what his opponent was going to do. People were usually so predictable.
Sir,
cautioned Suarez behind him.
That one too Muslim for comfort. That one was Latino. You always insist the good-looking ones are your cousins rather than mine. We really should go, sir.
Keramat turned to look at the head of his security detail. From the start, Suarez had understood the Home Secretary's insistence that he didn't want to know anything at all about the threats against him. You do your job and let me do mine, Keramat had said. Of course, when they cut down trees in his garden and put officers in their place, it was obvious there'd been some development. But Suarez maintained an air of calm through everything. Today, though, he was visibly anxious, and although Keramat had managed to insist on this riverside coffee, a post-sleepless night tradition stretching back to his earliest days as a backbencher, it was clear that he wouldn't win the argument twice. He was about to stand up when his phone rang and the screen told him it was his son. He cradled the phone in his hands for a moment, found the old empty habit forming the word Bismillah before he answered. Hi, Dad. Thought you'd be up. Eamon's voice was calm, affectionate. Nothing like that of the crazed thing who'd had to be physically restrained from returning to the arms of that manipulative whore. Well,
arms wasn't really the bit of her he wanted to return to, was it? Though Karamat probably shouldn't have said so at the time. You okay? He hadn't spoken to Eamon since Terry had arranged for Max and Alice to take him away to one of Alice's family estates after he'd moved from hysteria to a listless resignation. The press assumed the estate was the one in Norfolk, though it could just as well be Normandy. Karamat hadn't asked Terry not to tell him where their son was, but she knew well enough that it was information better kept from him in case someone asked him a direct question, which he'd have to answer honestly. His wife had always had a perfectly judged sense of who he was, who he had to be, as a public figure, which made it all the more mystifying when she packed up a segment of his wardrobe and moved it down to the basement bedroom in response to his officers breaking the story of Eamon's involvement with the girl. You could have protected him, she'd said, as if her husband were the kind of man either stupid or unethical enough to try to organize a cover-up. She hadn't relented when most of the newspapers correctly portrayed Eamon as a dupe, and some even managed to suggest he'd turned on the girl as soon as he'd realized what she wanted. Yes, I'm sorry how I behaved the other day. Karamat crossed a foot over his knee, considered the open-mouthed sturgeons with bulging eyes and entwined tails at the base of the nearby lamppost. Usually grotesque, they now appeared winningly comical to his benevolent gaze.
I'm sorry you're going to have a rough ride for a bit. Perhaps that move to New York your sister suggested might not be the worst idea. I worry about you more than me.
Karamat stood up and walked to the lamppost, leaned against it, and turned away from his security detail.
That's nice to hear, but unnecessary. It's just that from where you're sitting, it may not be clear how this looks. A government that sends its citizens to some other country when they act in ways we don't like. Doesn't that say we can't deal with our own problems? And stopping a family from bearing its own, that never looks good. That's what people are beginning to say around me. If your advisers won't tell you this, your son will. My son, schooling me in politics from his vantage point among the landed gentry, he said, pressing his knuckles into the bulging eyes of the fish. I'm saying this because your reputation matters to me, more than you know. She told you to say all this, didn't she? I haven't heard from her. You know that. I've done what you asked. I haven't called or texted. You said if I agreed, you would help her. How have you helped her? She's had police protection stationed outside her house. I haven't let the world see the kinds of videos her beloved brother worked on. She hasn't been locked up in an interrogation room for 14 days without charge, not even after admitting that she seduced my son in order to help a terrorist. You saw that transcript, didn't you? She admitted it. Of course she said that, once she thought I'd abandoned her. Do you hear yourself? Do you hear yourself? You think you're doing someone a favor by not locking them up for 14 days without reason? Please, don't try to develop a spine. You weren't built for it. Did she give you your first really great blowjob, Eamon? Is that what this is about? Because trust me, there are better ones out there.
A pause, and then his son's voice, at its most cuttingly posh.
I think we're done here, Father.
The call went dead, and Karamat turned around, crumpling the empty paper cup in his fist. Suarez stepped forward and extended his palm to take the cup, teeth marks visible on his thumb. He saw Karamat's eyes on the indentations and folded his thumb over his palm to hide the visual reminder of Eamon kicking wildly at the air, teeth clamped on Suarez's gag hand. Pivoting away from Suarez, he sent the paper cup flying in the direction of the garbage can. It hit the rim, bounced up, plummeted into the receptacle. Take out the trash. Keep Britain clean. Mid-morning in London, mid-afternoon Karachi, someone called at Cricket Boys uploaded pictures of a woman in the white of mourning, sitting cross-legged on a white sheet covered in rose petals. The sun-singed grass and the patches of damp on her chemise conveyed an extraordinary heat, despite the banyan tree under whose spreading branches and beard-like aerial roots she'd arranged herself. Hashtag knickers. Hashtag found her. All the press assigned to the Pasha story, scattered among upscale hotels and graveyards and family homes and airport terminals, descended on the park, only to be met by the blank stare and silence of a girl whom Karamat was beginning to suspect of being as unhinged as she was manipulative. "Find out where the body is," Karamat instructed his assistant James, eyes moving between the two TV screens in his Marsham Street office, one tuned to a Pakistani news channel, the other to an international one. The Pakistani channel had a split screen. One side showed scenes from the park, as increasing numbers of onlookers arrived to cluster around the girl, as if she were the site of an accident. The other showed a studio in which the urbane host of a religious discussion program explained what Sharia law had to say about the Pasha case. The man had slicked back hair and a black mark on his forehead, the latter a sign of piety, helped along by banging one's head against a stone or rough surface during the daily prostration of prayer. Karamat picked up a lion and unicorn paperweight, pressed it to his forehead. "First," said the man, "the boy had joined those modern-day Hajarites who were a greater enemy of Islam than even America or Israel, and so he should never be described as a jihadi. Second, he should have been buried before sunset on the day he died, no matter how far from home he was, and anything else was un-Islamic. Third, by her own admission to the UK police, the girl was a sinner, a fornicator, and should be flogged." Karamat made a note of the man's name and turned his attention to the international channel, where the anchor had pulled up a digital 3D map of the area surrounding the park and was describing the location as significant, as red circles appeared on the map identifying the gas station next to the park, the convent school and Italian consulate across the street, and the busy roundabout a stone's throw away. The 3D models of buildings and trees collapsed into the ground as if from a powerful detonation, and what remained was the figure of a girl facing the British Deputy High Commission. Karamat pressed the mute button and watched the doe-eyed girl in white, head covered, surrounded by blood-red rose petals, the park railings looking like a backdrop of prison bars in close-up shots of her. Nothing accidental in any of it. But what was all the iconography of suffering meant to achieve? James returned to say the Turkish embassy could confirm only that the body had arrived in Islamabad, but had no details of how or when it would be transported to Karachi, and the Pakistan High Commission had made it clear they expected an apology from the Home Secretary before they would reveal any information about their citizens to him. Karamat handed him the piece of paper with the urbane host's name, and said, "If he has a UK visa, find a reason to cancel it." "There are some people who think you're wanting a reason to strip her of her citizenship too," James said, indicating the girl on the screen, his accent turning more pronouncedly Scottish and working class, as it always did when he thought he might be about to enter into a disagreement with Karamat. It was a tick James was almost certainly unaware of, but Karamat had always found it winning that the young man's unconscious played his outsider status up rather than down when he challenged the Home Secretary. "And what do you think of that?"
"I think it's a terrible idea. Everyone will think it's because of Eamon."
"Everyone should know better," Karamat said. He stood up and approached the split screen.
"Damned if I know what she's planning next. Would you be standing as near her as all those people in the park?"
"You think she's wearing a suicide vest under those clothes?"
"No, I think she turns everything around her toxic. Look, It's all gone a bit yellow around her, hasn't it? Must be something wrong with the camera lens. I'm sorry, sir, about the suicide vest comment. Don't be silly, James. These are the times we live in.
The girl stood up fluidly from her cross-legged posture and stepped off the sheet. A single rose petal adhered to the top of her slim, bare foot. He imagined his son's mouth, pressed where the petal was, made a flicking away motion with his hand. Both TV channels were showing the same scene from slightly different angles, the air clearly yellow with an impending dust storm. The park, no more than twice the size of the lone family garden, was bound in by railings and banyan trees with an open gate toward which she was walking. A van had pulled up outside, an ambulance.
No. Oh, come on, no.
The driver of the ambulance opened the back doors, called out for some of the onlookers to help him. Far more men than was necessary lifted out the unadorned casket and carried it on their shoulders behind the girl, who, pale but composed, led them back to the white sheet and rose petals. The scene of martyrdom now complete. The men laid the casket down, but the girl wanted something more from them. She spoke to the man who had driven the ambulance. He shook his head vigorously, pointed to the hazy sky, indicating either the Almighty or the afternoon sun. She knelt beside the casket, placed the palms of her hands, one on top of the other, against the lid near the corner, and pressed down with all her weight, her knees lifting off the ground with the effort.
"Move the cameras away," he heard himself say.
The wood buckled, splintered.
"Jesus," James said. "Jesus, no."
The dupatta had fallen from her head, long hair whipping across her face as the wind picked up. The casket revealed its flimsy construction, nails ripping out of wood as the girl set to dismantling it with her bare hands. One by one she collapsed the sides until what remained was a shape sandwiched between the coffin's base and a top layer of plywood. The girl sat back on her heels, as if only now, at this moment, had she stopped to consider what she was asking her own eyes to look at. Or maybe she was waiting for what happened next. The yellow-brown wind picked up the plywood and flung it into the air with a whipping sound. The girl lowered herself to her knees, placed her hands on the ground on either side of her, and leaned forward, as a child might examine some unknown animal found in the garden. Her brother, embalmed, looked not right. How else to say it? Dead. She lifted a hand, looked at it as if she wasn't sure what it was about to do, and watched as her palm came to rest on the forehead of what had once been her twin. The hand jerked away, settled back down, slid along his skin toward his temple. Karamat and the cameras saw the stitches before she felt them, the place where death entered him. Her expression when she touched the thread was irritated, as if objecting to the untidiness, nothing more. The hand lifted again, moved down to the corpse's wrist, two fingers pressed against what would have been a pulse point. Her mouth opened, and a small word or sound may have come out, nothing the mics could pick up. James said the words,
"Broadcast regulations," with nothing around them.
Every phone in the room was ringing. Someone was knocking on the door.
"Shut up!"
Karamat shouted to everything. The dust storm that had sent its advance guard now arrived in a hurtling, pelting wind. The white sheet flew up at its corners, tossing aside the rectangles of wood that had weighed it down. Rose petals pitched up into the air, came down, muddied. Leaves were ripped from the banyan trees. The world tilted this way and that. The women wound their dupattas around their faces. The men made themselves small. One camera recorded only the flattened grass through a cracked lens. The other, moving closer to the girl, showed her dupatta fly toward it, a close-up of the tiny embroidered flowers on the white cloth, and then a battering darkness. For a few moments, there was only a howling noise, the wind raging, and then a hand plucked away the white cloth, and the howl was the girl, a dust mask on her face, her dark hair a cascade of mud, her fingers interlaced over the face of her brother. A howl deeper than a girl. A howl that came out of the earth and through her and into the office of the Home Secretary, who took a step back. As if that were the only thing the entire spectacle had been designed to achieve, the wind dropped as suddenly as buildings collapse in 3D models, and the girl stopped her noise, unlaced her fingers. The cameras panned, then zoomed. In the whole apocalyptic mess of the park, the only thing that remained unburied was the face of the dead boy.
"Impressive," said the Home Secretary.
The girl licked her thumb, ran it over her mouth, painting lips onto the dust mask. Then she looked directly at the Home Secretary and spoke. "In the stories of wicked tyrants, men and women are punished with exile. Bodies are kept from their families, their heads impaled on spikes, their corpses thrown into unmarked graves. All these things happen according to the law, but not according to justice. I am here to ask for justice. I appeal to the Prime Minister. Let me take my brother home."
Keramat spun the paperweight on the desk, watched the lion and unicorn animate, smiled. After all the noise and spectacle, she was just a silly girl. Prime Minister's questions was usually an embarrassment. Childish jeering and taunts, the PM parading his ability at that facile talent, the put-down, the Chancellor, or Chancer, as Keramat preferred to think of him, sitting beside him, with an expression both obsequious and smug close up, but that managed to look just the right degree of supportive on camera. Parliament, reduced to a playground. Keramat had been particularly dreading today, the first PMQs since the Pasha affair began. The PM, who had been abroad and out of touch the last few days, had been worryingly quiet on the whole matter, and any withholding of support from his Home Secretary would be a victory for the Chancellor and his leadership bid. But then the girl had opened her mouth.
"Heads impaled on spikes. Bodies thrown into unmarked graves. There are people who follow these practices. Her brother left Britain to join them."
The PM rose above party politics. The leader of the opposition rose to join him. There were hear-hears on either side of the aisle. The Home Secretary was lauded for the difficult decisions he had to make and the personal trials he'd undergone that had in no way affected his judgment or commitment to doing the right thing. Even the Chancellor had to lean across the space vacated by the PM as he stood at the dispatch box and pat Keramat appreciatively on the shoulder, a tiny nerve pulsing near his eye, which he saw Keramat recognize as defeat. James was waiting for him in his room behind the speaker's chair, mimicking some awful footballer's goal celebrations as he entered, the right mix of genuine and ironic. Not for the first time, Keramat wished his daughter and James would get together. But that set him off thinking about his children and their choice of partners. You could see Annika Pasha was the kind of girl who would do anything. A girl who looked like that and was willing to do anything. His poor boy never stood a chance. He sat down heavily in his chair, missed his wife. Not in the ways he used to miss her when he was Eamon's age, but in the way that only one parent can miss another when their child is in pain. He nodded at James to make the required call, and chose to speak in Urdu when his assistant handed him the phone, purely because he knew that pufferfish in human form who was the Pakistan High Commissioner would assume it meant the Home Secretary believed his English was inadequate. "What mischief are you people up to now?" Keramat asked.
That's a strange way to start off an apology, the HC replied in English. I'm not the one who has to apologize. That body would never have made it to the park if your government hadn't agreed to it or engineered it. Come, come, the HC said unconvincingly. The closest living relative asked for the body to be brought to a particular spot. On what grounds should the driver have refused? As for my government, it has bigger things to worry about than the logistics of a corpse. I assume someone is going to remove the body from the park, on the grounds of hygiene, if nothing else. I'm my nation's representative to the Court of St. James. Do you think I go around talking to municipal councils in Karachi? But maybe things are different in Britain, in which case, please tell my bin man not to make such a clanging noise when he comes around in the morning. How's your son's student visa application coming along? Actually, he's decided to go with Harvard rather than Oxford. The girl made some interesting points, don't you think? It was beginning to stop being enjoyable, so he switched to English. Fine. I spoke out of turn. Pakistan's judiciary is a credit to your nation. Bunch of bastards, the High Commissioner said unexpectedly. And then he was the one to switch languages, not to Urdu but Punjabi. Listen, I am a father too. I would want her off the news as well. It's not that. Oh, shut up, friend. I'm being sympathetic. Punjabi allowed this breach of etiquette, and Karamat felt something in his whole body shift, become looser. He tightened his shoulders against it. The issue is, my government has no reason to intervene. Intervene on decency's behalf? What kind of madness makes someone leave a corpse out in the heat to putrefy? The madness of love. Remember your Leila Majnu, Karamat? The lover so grief-stricken at the loss of the beautiful beloved that he wanders in madness in the desert. This beautiful girl in a dust storm has managed to become Leila and Majnu combined in the nation's consciousness. Or Sassi and Punnu in parts of the nation. Same story, except it's the girl who runs grief-crazed through the desert in search of her love. This nation, which has decided to cast her as a romantic heroine, is the same one that wants her flogged. Oh, people are already saying your government made up the whole story about her relationship with your son to discredit her, though opinion is divided whether it was you or one of your enemies who was behind it. Either way, for us to act against her now is difficult. For God's sake, man, do you really expect me to believe your government makes decisions based on a combination of folk tales and conspiracy theories? You really are as British as they say you are. Let me put it in language you'll understand. The people and several opposition parties have decided to embrace a woman who has stood up to a powerful government, and not just any powerful government, but one that has very bad PR in the matter of Muslims, and as recently as yesterday, insulted us directly. So, now, it's political suicide for my government to get involved. I hope we'll see you at our Eid reception. Until then, Allah Hafiz. The door swung open. The expected supporters, and some unexpected ones too, entered, bowing and throwing imaginary hats in the air. Karamat rubbed the back of his hand against his mouth, tasting dust. He was in a coffin made of slabs of ice, a prince in a fairy tale. The owner of the city's largest ice factory said he would supply his product free of charge. A truck driver said he would transport it as a religious duty. Everyone who had gathered in the park took turns unloading the ice slabs and passing them along a conveyor belt of human hands to the white sheet, now soaked through.
When the ice left their hands, they touched their red palms to their faces, the burn of cold against the burn of heat. Those nearest the corpse wrapped their faces in cloth. The translucency of the ice made it possible for the news channels to continue their live coverage without worrying about meeting broadcast standards. The corpse was little more than a blurry outline. The girl didn't assist with the continual rebuilding of the melting ice coffin, nor did she stop it. Her only insistence was that his face should remain uncovered. Now, as sunset bruised the sky, she stood with her back pressed against the banyan tree, her eyes never moving from that face.
"Is this the face of evil?" a tabloid asked, illustrating the question with a picture of the girl howling as dust flew around her. "Slag. Terrorist spawn. Enemy of Britain."
Those were the words being used to describe her, the paper reported, placing inverted commas around the words as proof. Would the Home Secretary strip her of her citizenship for acting against the vital interests of the UK, as surely she had done by giving ammunition to the enemies of Britain? The Home Secretary set the paper aside with a sound of irritation and resumed looking at Anika Pasha. Even when there was nothing new to report, there was always someone new to interview, and so the TV journalists were thrusting microphones into the faces of the representatives of civil society, who had shown up in support of the bereaved girl and were now starting to light candles in the deepening twilight. There was no need to do anything so dramatic as strip her of her citizenship, a move that could be traced back to personal motivations. She couldn't return to the UK on her Pakistani passport without applying for a visa, which she was certainly welcome to do if she wanted to waste her time and money. As for her British passport, which had been confiscated by the security services when she tried to join her brother in Istanbul, it was neither lost, nor stolen, nor expired, and therefore there were no grounds for her to apply for a new one. Let her continue to be British, but let her be British outside Britain. The candles threw their reflections onto the ice coffin. Flames trembled along its length, creating the impression of something stirring inside. Keramat walked over to the blinds, opened them to let in the afternoon sunlight, and looked down at the familiar scene of Marsham Street, suddenly so moving in all its quotidian details. Cars parked in parking spots, a woman walking by with shopping bags braided around her wrists, trees with thin trunks standing side by side. His London. Everyone's London. Everyone except those who wanted to harm it. He touched a vein in his neck, felt the reassuring warmth of his own blood. He returned home to Holland Park after Newsnight, a tough interview, as expected, but he'd maintained his calm, clarified that he had never made a decision about a corpse. His decision had been about a living enemy of Britain. He used the expression three times, which seemed just right, though he might have been able to get away with a fourth. The very word repatriation, which is what the girl wanted for her brother's corpse, rested on a fact of citizenship that had ceased to exist the day he, Keramat Lone, took office and sent an unequivocal message to those who treated the privilege of British citizenship as something that could be betrayed without consequences. No, he didn't think it was harsh to send that message, even to the girls who went as so-called jihadi brides. It was well past the point when anyone could pretend they didn't know exactly what kind of death cult they were joining. The British people supported him, and that included the majority of British Muslims. The news anchor had raised his eyebrows at that. "Are you sure?" he'd said. "There seems to be a common view, repeated on this programme just yesterday by a representative of the Muslim Association of Britain, that you hate Muslims." "I hate the Muslims who make people hate Muslims," he'd replied quietly. Up the stairs he went to the bedroom he'd been exiled from. Terry would have been watching, and she'd know how much that question wounded him. He was aware she would still be angry about what she saw as his failure to protect Aemon, but even so, she would have softened toward him. All he asked for was to be allowed to lie down next to her, not quite touching, unforgiven, but not unwanted. At some point in the night, she'd touch her foot to his. The once involved rituals of making up pared down to this single gesture over their more than 3 decades together. "Our love is almost middle-aged now," she'd said to him a few weeks earlier, at the anniversary of their first meeting, trying to hide how much she minded that he'd returned home very late from Marsham Street, having forgotten the date they always celebrated privately,
unlike the wedding anniversary, which was generally a family or more widely social affair. His memory lapse was particularly blundering, given that it came just months after she'd moved herself to a ceremonial role in her business, something she'd often talked about, but that he didn't think she'd ever do. "One of us has to be a fixed point in the universe, otherwise we'll keep missing each other," she'd said when she announced the decision, the only indication that she'd done it because his promotion to Home Secretary was imminent. The least he could have done in exchange was to remember the damn anniversary. He was generally a man to acknowledge a mistake the moment it was made, correct it. He had brought her breakfast in bed the next morning, and before leaving for work was attentive in other ways that pleased her, and never think of it again. This raking over a past failure was disquieting, adding to the wrongness of every part of the day, from Suarez's jumpiness to the conversation with his son, to the question about hating Muslims, to the girl, that fucking girl. "No," Terry said when he pushed the door open. "No. Out." "I'll sit there," he said, pointing to the stool next to her dressing table. "I spoke to our son. He told me what you said about the blow job. Are you an expert on the better ones out there? Whatever my failings are, you know that isn't one of them," he said, loosening his tie, kicking off his shoes. "Keramat, I mean it. Out." There was no arguing with her in this mood. Unbelievable that his son should have repeated that part of the conversation to his mother. Did he know nothing about the rules between men? Down the stairs he went again, to the consolations of a laughably expensive bottle of red wine, a gift that Terry had been saving for a special occasion. The ground floor was the place for formal entertaining, the basement the space in which he shut himself away from his family, each as alienating as the other in the circumstances. He took the wine outside, to the patio, where the moving shadows made him drop into a squat to offer as small a target as possible before he realized they were there for his protection. He finally ended up in the kitchen, sitting on the counter, swinging his legs as his children used to do when he would prepare breakfast for them while his wife was on a business trip somewhere. The kitchen table had long since been removed, and a gleaming chrome island was in its place to allow more space for cheese boards, platters of canapes, glasses, sorry children, flutes of champagne. He rolled up his sleeves, picked up the wine glass. The first Indian cricketer to be loved by the English, Ranjit Singhji, always wore his sleeves buttoned at the wrist to hide his dark skin. Something about holding an expensive glass of wine made Keramat understand how he'd felt. He let the wine sit in his mouth before it slid down with all the languor of the overpriced. There was a gentle knock on the door leading outside, and a moment later, Suarez entered.
"You're supposed to be off duty."
"My men called. There's someone who's been walking repeatedly up and down the street. Jones finally asked her what she wanted, and she said she knew you lived on this street but didn't know which house, and thought if she loitered long enough, your security detail would identify themselves." Keramat grunted in amusement.
"Who is she?"
"Isma Pasha, the sister."
"I know who that is. Bring her in."
In here, sir.
My mother didn't raise me to turn women out onto the street at midnight. And Suarez, there are only male officers tonight, aren't there? Keep the pat down minimal.
Too late for that, sir. Your security comes first.
When she entered, her eyes scanned the dimensions of the kitchen, and Keramat could already feel a judgment being passed.